This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 60 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe if you have a chance and you are enjoying the show. Those really make a difference and really help me out. So if you don't mind doing that, I'd appreciate it. A couple reminders, you know, some general announcements before I get into things with today's episode. I am doing a 10,000 follower giveaway, and I will tweet this out again, but basically, once I hit 10,000 followers, I'm going to pick a winner for a free month of online coaching, a free Challenger Strength t-shirt, and then a free Challenger Strength thin hoodie. To be eligible for the giveaway, just retweet or like the link or the tweet, I'm sorry, and then I also am providing a link just to put your name and email in. It's just a place where I can have everything settled so I can pick randomly from those who enter. I want to say I have like 50 entrants so far, which is pretty cool. I haven't tweeted it out since the first time that I did. So pretty cool that with some of the feedback and involvement in that, but definitely be on the lookout for that. And I'm probably like only like 200 followers away from 10,000. So I'll be picking that soon. Previous episodes to check out if you haven't already. Episode 59 with Bob Alejo. Bob, just say no more about him, just what he is in the industry and the, you know, similar to, I'm going to say episode 57 with Mike Boyle as well. Just two veterans of the industry that have a lot of experience and a wealth of knowledge to, you know, give to you as listeners and also me as a host, as a young coach. So, definitely check out episodes 59 and 57 with Mike Boyle and Bob Alejo. Episode 58 with the JUCO Bandit King himself, Eric Sim. Really cool episode in the sense that it was really authentic and, we kind of just had a very locker room-esque style of conversation, but in that same vein, it was just very informational, and Eric's just giving great insight on his journey through baseball and eventually all the way up to the AAA level of minor league ball, his conversion from a catcher to a pitcher, his training, strength training, and kind of a lot of, you know, where the game's going and the direction of things going forward for the game of baseball. So 59, Bob Alejo, 58, Eric Sim, 57, Mike Boyle. Check those out if you haven't already. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. They're great with some great guests. Coming soon, we have Aaron Borgman. Aaron was a athletic trainer for the Kansas City Chiefs for a number of years and now has his own private sector business. You know, excited to pick his brain on things related to injuries, preparation, treatment, all types of stuff like that in the realm of sports performance and injury care and athletic training. So super pumped to have him on. And then I'm also working on scheduling Dr. Greg Rose of On Base U and my TPI, Titleist Performance Institute. Again, say no more about that. I think that that explanation or description of who he is and what he does speaks for itself. On Base is, you know, become one of the biggest, you know, go-to places for baseball coaches to get well-versed in assessing movement of players and, you know, where they are in terms of how it relates to their hitting and their swing and all that type of stuff. So what they've done in that avenue has been fantastic, kind of piggybacking off of the success that they've had in the golf world and the golf industry. Just phenomenal stuff there. So super excited to have him on once we can work out that in the schedule. So be on the lookout for those two. Before I ramble on too much, because Chidi and I, so obviously, as you know, today's guest, Chidi Enya from Altus, just a very, very smart guy in general, but specifically when it comes to sprint training, sprint mechanics, and kind of all that goes into that and all that embodies it. We're talking all of that stuff today, you know, picking his brain on various things related to sprinting. We're getting mechanic specific. We're getting more broad in terms of general philosophies. And, you know, you're also going to get a little insight on Chidi's background and, you know, his own athletic careers and his own sprinting training and all that kind of stuff. So, if you're looking for an episode that's going to kind of show you, as a coach, what you should be programming with your athletes or looking for with your athletes to get them faster, or you're an athlete yourself just looking to get faster with your own training, definitely going to love this one. He was awesome, and it's just an hour and a half of just absolute knowledge bomb. So as always, I hope you guys enjoy. Give me any feedback that you may have, anything, questions, whatever, stuff like that. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. Till next time. Peace. All right, everyone, I'd like to welcome on Chidi Enya. Chidi, thanks so much for your time, man. Excited to have you.
All right, man. It's good to have you. It's good to be on the podcast, which I know we've been trying to connect for a little while now. So it's good that we were able to finally get it done. So I appreciate you having me on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. For the listeners, just so you know, we were supposed to start recording. I'm like 20 minutes late, 30 minutes late, and I was having like a mini meltdown that my Skype wasn't working. I was just able to kind of fix that and make it work. So we've been going back and forth for like, man, maybe 6 weeks, 2 months, like trying to make it work with recording. I had to cancel one day, and then it's just been, we're both very busy. So it's great that we were able to get it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Yeah, it should be a good one.
For sure. So kind of like I was going to touch on, and we're going to get to this a little bit. I want to kind of go into your background, but I just remembered what kind of got us connected in the first place. And I think it was I posted a video about basically like the drop step and the baseball specific starts. And that's always like a debate in the baseball community. And I think you had reached out to me saying you liked the post or whatever it was. And, I ended up like finding out obviously about your background as a sprint coach and everything. So that obviously meant a lot to me that, you know, I was thinking, hey, I must be, you know, going in the right direction here. If someone who, you know, teaches sprint specifically for a living, it liked what I posted and everything. So, I guess just first and foremost, before we get into a little bit of your background, because I have a lot of baseball listeners, like, what is your take on the whole drop step thing? And, you know, in your eyes, why you find it to be more effective?
Yeah, so early on, I'd say maybe like maybe 3 years ago, I, you know, started being exposed to more of the baseball community. And I was hearing that there was this debate, specifically like most of the time the debate was having to do with base stealing.
Yeah.
Right. So and so the debate was and this was like, you know, typically it'd be like between the strength coaches and like the position coaches and stuff like that. And the debate was whether or not, you know, someone is drop stepping or some kind of like variation of a drop step, or crossing over. And so it was like, well, what, so then it was like, what's being taught? So a lot of coaches, were finding that, like, you know, they needed to teach the crossover step. And for a while I was like, okay, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, I really didn't know where to go with this. So I just started researching and I just started watching a lot of video on, you know, what guys are actually doing in race, in their attempts to steal a base. And what I personally noticed was, I have never seen one athlete, one baseball player actually cross over or execute a crossover step, to steal a base. So then my question was, if no athletes are crossing over to steal a base, why is the crossover step being taught for base stealing? And what I noticed was what people were inaccurately describing about the drop step or the derivatives of it was they were saying like, well, when that, you know, if you're going to steal a base, when that right leg picks up or pivots, typically it comes off the ground at least a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when it picks up and it strikes back, to the ground, it's going to strike back and be either under the hip or slightly behind the hip. And this was seen as a lost step, right? This was seen as losing ground, whereas the crossover step was seen as gaining ground. And so to me, that was, you know, that was kind of it. Like it was just a description of a lack of understanding of the purpose of that specific, of the drop step, action, as it relates to base stealing. And so I just started to break that down and started to look at like, well, what is acceleration? Because the whole point, of someone stealing a base is to get from first to second or second to third or whatever as fast as possible, like without getting caught, right?
Yep.
And so naturally, What I found was that despite the fact that that a lot of coaches were teaching the crossover step, the athletes themselves were selecting, like their brains were selecting the most useful strategy to get from point A to B. And that was, to have that aggressive push off of the left leg, towards the direction of the run, torso rotate towards, let's say, for example, second base, have that right leg pick up and strike under the hip. And I looked at that and I just drew the comparisons to a sprinter coming out of the blocks or anyone executing a linear sprint, whether it be a 100-meter dash, 60-meter dash, 40-yard dash, or whatever. And I said, well, what's the purpose of that foot striking back to the ground where it does? Like, is that – that's not a lost step. Like, that whole – the whole point of that step is to position the foot where, so that that athlete can have a more favorable horizontal propulsive profile, so that they can get into that run, more immediately and not have to drag their hip over their foot to get going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So then with the crossover step, I said, well, a lot of people were saying the crossover step, you know, the purpose of it was to gain ground. But what I appear to notice was that, when they swung, you know, basically people are stuck on the right leg. And then when they swung that left leg through, when that left leg struck the ground, if you're actually doing a crossover step, like if you're doing the crossover step as it's being taught, when that foot struck the ground, that foot was going to be ahead of the hip. So you might have this, you might possibly have like a long, like stride length, but because of the position of the foot, relative to the hip on the ground, you're going to compromise velocity and you're going to compromise your ability to propel yourself or get into the acceleration process with kind of,
you're going vertically then, right? You mentioned getting linear. Yeah. Like that's the most important part.
Yeah, you're going to have to, so the shin is going to be more vertical.
Yep.
So technically you would have to be upright. So if you're not going to be upright, you have to force the torso down. But because that foot is going to be out in front of the hip, before that athlete can really get going, that hip has to pass back over that foot.
Yep.
So that hip has to travel back over that foot. So that athlete is going to stall for a little bit.
It takes more time.
Before
they
can actually get going.
Yeah.
Exactly. It takes more time. So yes, you may have covered ground, but you sacrificed velocity in the process. So it's, you know, so that's not a, for me, a useful strategy at all, you know?
Yeah. I would like that. That was just like really well said. And I think the one thing I noticed too, and then it was two things. One, you mentioned, the hip and the position of it. I also would say, like, when I'm teaching an athlete to sprint, like, if they make contact, in their first couple strides and their shin is too vertical, then what's going to happen is at ground contact, they're going to stall, like you said, to let that shin shift into positive angle, right? So if obviously in acceleration, like, you know, longer ground contact time is a part of it, but like, if you're even lengthening that out even more because of, you know, poor positioning and you make contact in the ground in a spot that you don't want to be in, like you said, your body's going to naturally stall so that it can get into position. So you're thinking along the lines of, all right, well, I'm not going to take that quote unquote false step because it's going to lose ground. But what you end up doing it just to gain a little bit there maybe is you're really screwing up the entire pattern of everything kind of going forward. And I think the second point on that too, and this is something I've really come to notice maybe in the last couple of months. I don't even think it was something that I had really thought of, to be that, of like the top, you know, priorities in the reason, for the drop step until after we had first spoken, but the ability to use that step, to get the shoulders and the hips square, basically let's say you have a guy on first base, we're talking baseball specifically here, you know, you want to get your shoulders and your hips square to that direction in which you're trying to get to. So
the base, yeah,
it's so much easier to accomplish that. Like when, and this is something I've been cueing a lot lately with my baseball guys. If you take that, you know, front hand, that front arm and that front hand in your base stealing position and aggressively cue that, you know, pulling across your pocket, so to speak, you know, with the drop step, you can really do a good job of like, immediately getting your shoulders and hips opened up and squared to what you're trying to get to. Whereas with that traditional crossover, that might not be as easy, right?
Yeah, you have to, it seems as though, and this is just from what I've seen, it's like with the crossover step, it seems as though you have to maneuver around that stance leg, the leg that you're crossing, that you're swinging the left leg past. Whereas with the drop step, you know, that right leg is going to pick up and it's going to open. That hip is going to open and that foot is going to come back to the ground. And that foot itself is going to have a better orientation towards, it's going to be more square towards the base you're approaching. The torso is going to turn aggressively. And when that foot strikes the ground, that torso turns, you're already going to be in this coordinated, timing, like more favorable timing position. To get into the sprint right away. So you have a more favorable foot contact with the ground relative to the hip, and you have a more favorable upright or torso position, arm position. So now you're ready to go right away. And like, so for me, it's very problematic that so many people are teaching the crossover while at the same time watching baseball and seeing no one cross over to steal a base.
Yep.
But then like, so the implication is that like the drop step is supposed to be wrong, I guess, but like we're literally teaching something that doesn't exist, in the context of base stealing. Like, for example, if you take a sprinter, you take someone, coming out of the blocks, they're going to be set up in a position, the best mechanically advantageous position possible, so that, you know, they can get into that acceleration process violently and efficiently, right? Mm-hmm. If the first, when they leave the block, the first contact with the ground is supposed to be directly under or behind the hip. And this is going to depend on the skill and the strength, power, all of those things. This is going to dictate how far behind or at the hip, or how far behind the hip that foot contact. Every step after that is going to inch further and further to the front.
Yep.
Now, if we had an athlete come out of the blocks and that first contact with the ground slams in front of the hips, almost to the point where that foot is flat on the ground,
it's like a break.
That person is literally stalling. They're stalling the hell out because the foot is in front of the hip, and therefore they're having to pull themselves. The hip can't displace with any kind of velocity, any kind of efficiency. So they won't be able to get going until that hip displaces past that foot again, right?
Yes.
And so it's the same exact thing in base stealing. If that foot contacts in front of the hip, there's going to be a stall. Hip isn't going to displace with any kind of efficiency, any kind of velocity, and it's going to take a little while to get going. Meanwhile, the hamstrings and adductors are all being exposed to, you know, repeat trauma if this is that person's specific, you know, style of acceleration. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I even liken it to, like, if you had athletes working in some just basic two-point stance work and you just told them to stand there and they didn't really load any of their weight. Let's say, like, for argument's sake, you had them get into, like, 60-40, you know, weight distribution. So, like, 60% of their load was on their front leg. Let's say their left leg was forward in the two-point stance, their right leg was behind. And you had like 60-65% of the weight loaded on the front side, up on the toe a little bit. They would be able to just, you know, get going into their sprint and push right off and go. Versus if you just said, okay, guys, like, you know, staggered, you know, 2-point stance, and go, a lot of them wouldn't position their weight, you know, at all. And you would really see a natural drop step even in that 2-point stance. And that just, in my mind, that kind of showed me, it's like, all right, well, it's a preparation thing. It's like, You can make the argument as a person who believes in the crossover step that, hey, if we position the person's load on their lead leg in the baseball stealing position, then they can, you know, maybe effectively cross over because they're going to be loaded on that side already. My thing is, one, I'm not even sure if that is more optimal, but if you made the argument that it's the same and it's just as good and you wouldn't have to take that false step, my point is, like, the baseball is too reactive for you to get in that set solidified position every time. So it's like, I'm never going to be at a point in at first base, second base, wherever I am, even in the outfield. Like, it's just a move that's executed all over the field. Like, you literally see a center fielder go to take off for a ball over his shoulder and that he uses a drop step.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's like that is the reactive way to go about it. It's the most optimal way to do it when it's a reactive sprint.
Right. Because, and the thing we have to change is this idea that, like, we have to redefine what false step means. Like, because I think in baseball, false step has this massively negative connotation, when the whole purpose of that quote unquote false step is to be in the best position to propel yourself forward. That's it. It's not a lost step, because the position of the foot relative to the hip means that that person can now immediately propel themselves forward, or propel themselves in the direction of the run. You know what I mean? That's the whole purpose of it. So if we can redefine what false step means, and stop saying that it's false with a negative connotation, or saying that it's like lost ground, and we understand basic principles of acceleration, then we'll see. It's the reason why, like, on my Instagram, you'll see that pic. There's a split video of Andre DeGrasse, who's run sub 10 in the 100, and then Bradley Zimmer on the top. Bradley Zimmer is going through his lateral acceleration, simulating a base deal. Andre's going through his coming out of the blocks. And I give a very detailed description of the acceleration processes, the similarities and the differences of both athletes. So if people just understand or learn and understand basic acceleration principles, then there's no way you can call that a false step, in the sense that it's lost ground. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know what I mean? So,
I prefer drop step.
Drop step is, that's what I typically use.
I like what you're saying. It gives it a bad context where it's like, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
Even if, like, this is super, like, into semantics of, like, baseball specifically, but, like, think about if a kid's at a showcase and they're using a laser timer, and you drop step, you're getting started before you cross the timer. That's beautiful. That's, like, why you wouldn't want, like, you're going to probably save yourself a tenth of a second. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, you already.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You already got going before the timer.
You've already got going. Yeah. You know, that foot hits down and right. And the hip, because the hip is going to start to displace the moment that, the moment you initiate movement, the hip is going to start to displace to the right. If let's say you're going to steal second base, the hip is going to start to displace immediately. And that's the important point. It's the hip displacement. So left leg push, hip displace to the right. Well, because that foot, if that foot didn't strike the ground under or slightly behind the hip, the right foot, then the hip isn't going to continue to displace efficiently, or that velocity, the velocity of that displacement isn't going to continue to increase. You know what I mean? So that's like, you know, if they're drop stepping, you know, and like they're doing, you know, doing a laser start, then you're going to enter, you're going to break the beam with a little bit more velocity than you would if you were swinging that lever across the body, trying to cross over, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing too is the understanding that, like, even to play devil's advocate, if you wanted to say that you were sacrificing or quote unquote giving up ground, I got into a big argument with Dallas Braden. Dallas Braden pitched in the big leagues for, you know, almost 10 years. Great guy. I ended up having him on my show a couple months after, because we ended up talking, you know, everything through, and it became like a really nice, you know, respectful conversation. But we had a little bit of an argument right away because, you know, he had said that it was Ronald Acuna on the Braves. He had, like, oh, he lost ground and that's why he got thrown out. I think even if you want to play devil's advocate and say, okay, like, you want to frame it in your mind as you're losing ground because you're technically stepping, you know, behind you, here's two things that I like to look at.
Right.
One, IQ, there's a very important emphasis on that kind of impulse and push off the, so let's say in the baseball start, that left leg, right? Your right leg's in front of you, your left leg's kind of the back leg. The push off the backside, if you watch old videos of Jose Canseco, he did it beautifully. He would get so much drive and pulse off that back leg, it would almost extend as he was, you know, turning and rotating and dropping the front leg, you know, back down. So I look at it as you want to say, okay, you're losing ground and the front leg is dropping back. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as like that is there for position, but you've pushed your center of mass closer to where you're getting with that push off the backside. So what ground did you lose?
Exactly. That's exactly what I was saying. The hip is moving towards the base.
Yes, and that's you can't say that's drop. That you can't say that's losing ground.
Exactly. You know. So
and then
that's
my other point was even if you want to give them that, if they want that, they can have it. Right. My next point would be: so what? Yeah. You're putting yourself in a more optimal position for the rest of the sprint.
Precisely.
Right.
Precisely.
So even if they want to have that and hang on to that, that's what I would say to them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, that's the point.
Yeah. So you're lucky. You don't get as wrapped up in the baseball community sometimes because there are some really, really stubborn people that want to stick to the way things have been done or that they've been thought to be done for years. And, you know, it really does help, though, I have to say. It helps when someone like you with your background in sprinting can come in and kind of shed some light on the area and the topic because it helps, I guess. Like, people, like, I look at it this way, like I'm good at teaching sprints in the baseball community or the sport community, but then there's a whole different animal of like, there's a sprint coach. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I'm good at it for what I can offer to it for athletes in the role of a strength coach, I like to say, but like, I'm just honest with myself. I'm nowhere near what a regular sprint coach, that's their specialty and that's what they do. Like, I try to learn from guys like you and guys that are literally teaching sprints. That's like what you do. I have to be a little more diverse in what I'm doing. So like, I try to be a really good sprint coach, and I know that I'm good in the realm of like, you know, baseball or football or strength coaches, but not, you know, to someone who teaches, you know, athletes to run track or whatever. So I think it's important that people like you and coaches like you get involved in the conversation a little bit to really shed some light on it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I've been fortunate enough to get connected to a number of dudes in the baseball world who, you know, some who I help out on a fairly regular basis and others who I just talk to, you know, and so like, you know, there's this trade-off of knowledge, you know what I mean? Like we can talk sprinting and this, that, and the other, and then they can contribute to like my understanding or growing my understanding of baseball, you know what I mean? And which is like the further I go along, you know, it's very helpful because, you know, I need to, have a thorough understanding of the sport too, to be able to put what I know in the right context and and put it forward in a way that's useful for, you know, for the baseball community or any community that I happen to be fortunate enough to interact with, you know.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And I say it all the time, like as a strength coach, like you got to be, you know, looking at the best bodybuilding coaches and the best bodybuilding principles, the best powerlifting coaches and powerlifters and powerlifting principles. I say it all the time. It's like as a strength coach, you're a giant melting pot. Like you need to be looking at the best sprint coaches to ever do it. Like I read a lot of Charlie Francis stuff and I look at guys now that are doing it currently, you know, on social media. Like I have to try to find the best person in each avenue and get as good as I can in those things because I have to do all of them. You know what I mean? Like it's a multifaceted thing. And if you're a strength coach and you're kind of limiting yourself to, you know, one discipline, you're really going to limit what you can do to help your athletes. I think that's important, for sure.
Absolutely. 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 I, you know, have the same approach. You know, sprinting has been my, you know, speed power development has been my big thing, but the strength conditioning aspect of it I've been heavily involved with for my entire career. 23 years, but like, you know, because I'm involved with a lot of other sports too, it's like, man, you can take from it all, and you find out what's useful and what's not and go from there. But at the end of the day, like, your process of evolution, should be vast. You know what I mean? It should involve a lot of different, pulling information from a lot of different sources and extracting what you find useful and you know, for your demographic, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of, and I love the fact that this just happened. I do an outline for each show, and basically we jumped right into something I didn't even have written on here, which I love. I think that's the best. Yeah. But before we get into, because I wanted to have an entire conversation with you on mechanics and everything generally, but I did. Yeah. I'd be remiss not to get into your background a little bit, because I like to give the listener a little idea of like what the guests, you know, where they come from and their careers, whether it's athletics or whatever, education. So getting a little bit into like your own athletic background, you know, sports played, like, and if you could honestly, I know this is like a vague question, but it's something I really wanted to ask you, like, what type of sprinter were you, if you know what I mean by that? Like, you know, I don't really know much about you other than like, you know, what you do. Like, I don't know how tall you are or whatever, but like, I know that has a big impact on what type of sprinter you are. Like, if you had to summarize that, what would you say?
Well, so basically I specialize in the short sprint. So okay. I was 100, 200 meter guy. I also was a long jumper and triple jumper in high school. So
I love watching triple
and
jumps.
And I was, you know, one of those. Yeah, dude, it's crazy, right?
The ground contact and elasticity. Guys, yeah.
But I was one of those athletes that, you know, high volume was not my forte.
Okay.
You know, so you know, I wasn't the type of guy that could run a bunch of 400s and 500s and all that kind of stuff. I could barely run a good 200. Okay. You know, to be honest, but I could sprint short distances, and I can jump. And when I coming up, I played football and ran track in high school. But I grew up playing soccer. That was like the first sport I was exposed to. I'm second generation Nigerian. So, okay. Like, you know, in Nigeria, soccer is number one.
Yeah.
Soccer is number one all over the world. But you know what I mean? So, and then I went to college and played football there. I went to Illinois State University.
Cool.
I was a running back. So you can probably guess like what my, you know, kind of what my morphology is. You know what I mean? Like, you know, bit stocky,
yep.
You know, whatnot. And then after college, I played, I wanted to continue playing football, but I just had so many injuries. But I started running track post-collegiately. I was the type of guy that, at least over time, I started figuring out that I was, you know, a guy that can be exposed to, you know, more high intensity work, more frequent dosages of high intensity work. Shorter distances on the efforts, and I was a guy that can hit weights. I can hit weights I pretty much fed off of weights more than like, let's say, the more elastic profiled type of athletes. You know, the more wiry type of athletes. You know, so that's probably how I would describe myself as a sprinter.
So you mentioned right off the bat that like you were more of a lower volume kind of guy. I could really say I was very similar. So, I was like, I'm a bigger dude. Like I'm like 6'2", 275 currently. I didn't play that size, but I played baseball. I gained a lot of weight once I stopped playing. I just lived in the gym. And got like, I ended up becoming like a lineman post baseball career. So anyway, I always like, I didn't know these things back when I played, but I always wondered in my mind, like, how was I a faster guy even though I was a bigger one, right? Like, it didn't make sense to me. I didn't know what I know now about muscle fibers and type 2 and type, like, fast twitch, slow twitch. But, like, it really dawned on me, like, growing up, like, I had a really – like, I could have been in the best shape of my life. I remember in college, if I was, like, 225, like, I had a great body fat levels. I was really in shape in the weight room. But, like, we had to run a 6-minute mile test, and I couldn't do it for the life of me. Like, I really struggled. But then – If you put me up in sprints against even some of the smaller, quote unquote, quicker guys on the team, I would compete with them or even beat them. Like I was a really, I think my best ever 60 yard dash time was like a 6.76 hand time at like 230 pounds. So I moved really well,
but
it never made sense to me. Like, I was like, how is that possible that I'm a bigger, like, I didn't know, but now I realize that like the struggles that I have with the long distance stuff and, you know, me being a better sprinter and a guy that threw hard and hit the ball for power, I had a lot of fast switch muscle fiber. Now I understand that, but I didn't know what that was back then. You would definitely classify yourself as someone who was the same. Like, you struggled with, you know, anything over, like you said, even 200s, you had a little bit of an issue with, but you were, you know, an elite, a good jumper and, you know, a good short distance sprinter. Like, there's really important, it's really important to understand where you fall in those categories as an athlete, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a big part of the battle is trying to figure out, like, what your profile is. And yeah, like I was a workhorse. You know, I did so much volume. I wasn't afraid to just do work and to grind and do all of that stuff. And I was, when I was in college, I was anywhere from 210 to 225. And I was fast. I could jump out the roof. I could do all kinds of stuff. I just was always hurt. But I noticed, like, even after college, when I figured out that I needed to scale back on volume just based on what performances look like, on the track, I just noticed that, like, I responded so much, so much better to that stuff. I was just a product of, when I was younger, just having, like, a lot more, I sought out some help. Well, my high school coaches were kind of, old school in the sense that, like, volume was the name of the game, when it came to, coaching track, and then the people that I consulted with for help after, college, when I started pursuing track outside of college, kind of had, like, the same mentality. But it also didn't help that I was 230 pounds, trying to run a 100-meter dash, and I'm only 5'10 and a half. So, I think once you figure out what kind of athlete you are, or once a coach figures out what kind of athletes they're working with, then that, basically helps guide, the programming. It helps determine, like, what types of training you can expose them to better guarantee, success, for them. And that's kind of like something you got to go through with your whole group, at least. And if you have large groups, it just means that, you'll just have, break them down into general categories so that you're not, like, so meticulous that you can't actually coach. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned a good point too. Like, you have to understand, as much as you want to zero in and do things that help each individual athlete, like, there is something to be said for the fact that if you're training, like, 40 kids at the same time, like, you have to be able to actually train them, and not get too specific where it's impossible to, execute everything. But I do think it's super important. And this is why I'm so passionate about, like, stopping baseball players from, like, having to run long distances when they don't really do anything for them. Like, I was this fast twitch kid trying to train for a 6-minute mile time when, like, it, one, wasn't important for the sport, and two, like, it was really hard for me to do just because of how I was as an athlete. Like, you train for what you need in the sport first and foremost, and then train for the qual. Like, if you don't throw hard or hit the ball far, and you're training yourself for a running event that is really, slow twitch based, that's not going to help you. Like, you should be doing the sprints to get you increase your power and, fiber composition as much as you possibly can. So I think that's important. And, it's interesting to hear what, your background was and as an athlete yourself. I think that's important for sure. So training throughout your career in terms of, like, your sprint training and, your strength training, obviously, you mentioned you were up to 230 pounds. So I'm sure, and played football. So I'm sure you were getting after it in the weight room, but what was, your sprint training like, and a little bit about what your strength training was like?
Yeah. So, sprint training, I mentioned earlier, in high school, it was very high volume, longer distances, lots of repeat 400s and all that crazy stuff that I couldn't do. So I was always hurt with that. When I went to college, played football, I had a really good strength and conditioning coach. His name is Robert Lindsay. He works with Powerlift right now. He's been with them for a number of years. He's probably my favorite coach in college. And that's when I started to get a good idea of what, more competent training looked like for speed and power. So with more shorter distance, doing acceleration work, and we still had to condition. I mean, we played football, so we still had to condition, but it wasn't like, running like repeat 300s or anything crazy like that. When I left college, or when I left undergrad, I worked with a couple of coaches, but those relationships didn't last long for a number of reasons. It just didn't work out. And then, so what happened was I started to study. I somehow found Charlie Francis online, and so I got on the CharlieFrancis.com, and CharlieFrancis.com was a big resource for me. That was like the first major sprint training resource I was exposed to. So at that point, I started to see, you know, looking at, you know, more vertical integration style approach, and more of a short to long looking program. So there was a much greater emphasis on doing the acceleration work right out of the gate, and things like that. The volume, at least that I tried to do when looking at Francis' program, was still a bit high, just the total workload. So over time, I just kind of learned to scrap some of that and adapt it more to what I can do and what I found to be more useful. After being exposed to Charlie, then it was Dan Pfaff, and it was Gary Winkler, then it was a number, you know, Bruce Schneider, and then it was just like a number of different, like Al Vermeil, different coaches and practitioners that started to expose me more to the idea of doing more sprint work right out of the gate, and biasing the training towards that. Depending on like what your actual like goals are, like what sport are you participating in, and what are the needs of that sport. For me, it was track and field. So, you know, you had to do a needs analysis for the event. And, you know, one key thing was to, you know how to accelerate. So acceleration is a big point. Max velocity is a big point, and then specific endurance. And then you kind of work around those things, you know. So it got much more specific to short distance, more powerful efforts. And but then in the weight room, it took me a long time to, I grew up being fascinated with the human body and human performance. I used to read comic books as a kid all the time. I used to draw comic book characters. I used to read all the bodybuilding books and this, that, and other. So a lot of my weight room work was a little bit too much. You know, even in my coaching career, I used to have people lifting too much. So that was one of the things that I did wrong. As a youngster, and even early in my attempted post-collegiate career, was I was lifting hard, lifting long, and all of that lifting was robbing me of the resources I needed for the work that I had to do at the track. So over time, that shifted. I started understanding that I needed to like not go overkill on weights, and then the results started to flip, where I was getting much better results over time.
I think that's a great example. I like to say, like, as great as it is to get strong, and as much emphasis that I put on it, and getting, you know, strength training, it's just so much, and we know that obviously. But like, no one cares how strong you are if you suck, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was crazy because like
you're a sprinter. You needed to be sprinting.
yeah, exactly. I was in college. And my, you know, college strength coach can confirm this, and a bunch of the guys I played with, I ran a 4.28 and a 4.29 in college at like 225.
Wow.
You know, and when I did that, when I was going into post collegiate track, I was like, well, if I'm 225 and I can run a 4.28 and a 4.29, I should be able to run sub 10. Like, I was completely oblivious to like what it takes to run sub 10. Like, you know. And so I was like, well, let me get bigger and stronger, because
which would have helped with the first like little bit of that. Like that, we're going to talk about, you know, acceleration mechanics in a little bit. Like, that little added weight might have improved your acceleration, but just because of the pure force and everything. But you would have struggled later on into top speed.
Oh, absolutely. It would have, and for what I was working with, it would have, it was only beneficial for like 5 meters.
Yeah.
You know, the more,
which is can be helpful in a sport, but not when you're trying to run a little bit longer for track.
Exactly.
Like
if,
yeah.
Exactly.
Like you look at linemen, I look at linemen all the time, and I have like my receivers would ask me this question, like my running or my skill players, like how come my 10 isn't that much different than the 265 pound center? And I'm like, well, because acceleration's predicated a lot on just, you know, strength and force and et cetera. But, you know, if we ran 30 to 40 to 50 yards outside, you would smoke him. Like, he's going to get you in the first little 10 yards. And that's why I also say, like, I have these linemen come to me and like, my coach said, like, you know, they want to see my 40 under a 5, like a 4.9 or whatever. And I'm like, I get it. Like, yeah. if you run a fast 40 overall, there's no way that you're slow. But like, wouldn't I want to care more about like what their first 10 yards are as a lineman? Like, their whole position is based on like being in a static position and exerting as much force as possible from that static position. Like, that's the first 10 yards of your sprint. So anyway, I think that's a great point with what you said, like how it would help that one area, but like it would kind of curtail you as you were getting more into top speed and the remainder of your sprint for sure. So that's really interesting. And it kind of just shows, you know, at the end of the day, you need balance. Like, you know, we can stress weight room. It's great, but like, you know, you need to be sprinting. You need to be doing the stuff that you're actually going to be doing. And you have to also understand, like, every pound you gain requires more strength and power. Like, think about it. Like, you know, Usain Bolt, for example. I think Usain Bolt, like, it's like six point something times his body weight he would put into the ground every time he made stride contact. Think about the significance of that if he gained 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
How that ratio gets skewed, right?
Right. That's the his strength to weight ratio or his relative strength, right?
Yep.
But that's, you know, is you know, like you said, is, you know, the, like, let's say to improve acceleration, a big part of that is max effort work or max strength work. Max strength work is low velocity, high force activity, which more closely mirrors acceleration. Early acceleration. You're on the ground for longer periods of time because you're trying to build momentum. You're going from zero velocity. So the ground contacts are longer. It's high force, but the further along you move up the field or the track or the closer you get to max velocity, the more that force profile shifts to high force, high velocity, which calls for shorter ground contact time. You know, so you can't, you know, if, you know, someone like myself who's trying to run 100, like I said, I might have been good for 5 meters, you know, but at each step of the, you know, along the way, you know, guys are pulling away from me, you know, and pretty easily. So it was, you know, having all that strength and spending all that time in the weight room was just counterproductive. I had gone beyond. I had reached that point of diminishing returns a long time ago. You know,
and that's the key right there. It's like no one's trying to say that you can you can say that the weight room didn't help you anymore after a certain point without it meaning that you didn't like the weight room. It was just like, all right, like I squat 500 pounds and I'm 225 and I'm jacked. Like maybe there's some other things that I should be focusing on. You know, I'm at the speed that I am. Like, what's going to make me faster? Going to run more sprints or getting up to 235 and squatting 600 pounds? Maybe. I had a great quote from one of my guests one time is, no one's ever saying you can ever be too strong in the context of 0.89 seconds in that ground contact time. The stronger you can get, the more force you can exert in that 0.89 seconds is fantastic. What they are saying is you can be strong enough, so to speak, when you're using 4 to 5 seconds to, you know, lift a heavy load on a squat. Like, I don't think that's going to really do much for you when, great, you can lift 600 pounds, but it takes you 4 seconds to complete the rep. Like, that's way too long of a window for that to be applicable whatsoever to your ground contact in a sprint, right? So it's like,
totally.
So coaching and getting, so like, obviously you're at Altus now, and what led you there? How long have you been there? And kind of like, I guess, you know, everyone knows like how high level of a place that it is and what's being done. So like, who wouldn't want to coach there? But I guess I am curious, like what led you there and what made you drawn to wanting to be a part of it?
Yeah. So, I was coaching in the NCAA. I was at Southern Illinois University, for 5 years, 1 year as a volunteer, assistant, and then 4 years as a men's, women's, sprints, hurdles and relays coach. 2014, my contract wasn't renewed. So I was looking for work. During my time at SIU, I had established some good relationships with a lot of good people throughout the NCAA. One of my buddies ended up, went down to what was Altus was formerly known as World Athletic Center. So he had gone down there to the World Athletic Center and was coaching. And once when I became available, he reached out to me and said that he was just like, hey, you want to come down here and coach? And this was just like, you know, out of the blue. It was cool. And I one of the things that I'd been doing, you know, for probably about 6 or 7 years prior to going to Altus was I would have like a emerging elite athlete, you know, here and there. You know, every year I'd have like one, maybe two emerging elite athletes. But I always had the desire to coach at the highest level possible, you know. And so when that opportunity was presented to me, it was a no-brainer. I was like, yeah, of course, I'll come down to Arizona and you know, be one of the coaches of a world-class group of sprinters and jumpers and hurdlers. And so I've been down here since 2014. So, it's, you know, it's a great experience. You know, a lot of things you learn when you've gone through the ranks, you know what I mean? Like I've worked with the youth level athletes, worked with high school, worked with college, and then, you know, with the pros, and then with actual like world class athletes. And there are a lot of things that are different, but then there are lots of things that are very similar. So, you know, that's kind of how that came about, you know, just making some good connections, building some good relationships. And then, you know, when the time came, I happened to be available, and I got a call, and I was like, yep, I'll see you down there.
Yeah. You know? How important, like, for the younger coaches listening, and this is like some of the advice that I give to any coaches that reach out to me and, you know, are curious, like, how can I get started, whether it's just a strength coach or anything, like, what I want to make my name and get a following. And I always tell them, like, you have to be able to, you know, track the results you're getting with the early athletes you may be working with. And I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of saying, like, how you would get those early athletes. I've talked about that a lot in terms of, like, maybe doing some free work. Yeah. Just giving yourself a way to get your hands on some athletes and help them. And tracking what you do with them, because then you can kind of show that to people and say, hey, I know what I'm doing. Like, this is what I do, and this is how I do it. How important would you say it is to be able to do that, so that when you are trying to get your foot in the door and create these relationships, like, people say, hey, this guy knows, or this girl knows what she's doing. Like, I want to, you know, see more of what they do, or bring them on, or maybe if you're in the private sector, you're, you know, athletes look at you and say, hey, I want to go to you to get better. Like, how important is that?
Yeah, it's hugely important. Like, because, you know, people, you know, it's one thing to, cause you know, like a lot of people will get jobs based off of like who they know. Right. So sometimes it's about who you know, and this and another, but like that, you know, whoever's going to hire you still wants to know that you have, you know, are going to be competent and do some good work. You know what I mean? And so like over, you know, prior to Altus, or even prior to SIU, like I'd had years of like working with, youth athletes, to where like, you know, had a number of people, you know, qualified for the, you know, the Junior Olympics and, you know, coaching at the high school level. You have, you know, you got, you know, the state meet, you know, qualifiers for the state meet and state medalists and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, you have to log all of that information, you know, because that's your resume, you know, and if you're doing that, you know, like all of that helps, but then like, you know, just kind of surround yourself with a network of good people, people who you trust, people who are, more knowledgeable than you, obviously. But also people who just have like, you know, can share experiences that differ from yours. But like you have to, you know, when you're starting out, you have to log that stuff. You have to log those results, just kind of log the process. The processes that you go through with certain athletes, so that when those times come where you have to make a case for yourself, you know, you can do that and do it well. you know?
Yeah, for sure. I think the message that I always try to, you know, put out there is just, you could be good at what you do, but if you don't have, any like evidence of it or anything to show anybody, like it makes it a lot harder for you. So you can really make it a lot easier on yourself. Yeah. Like you could be working at the smallest college, smallest high school, whatever. But if you're getting results with those people, you might get a bigger time company or a bigger time name, or you might be able to start your own business. Yeah, if you have those results behind you and you have ability to show them to people.
Right. And coaching is coaching, man. Like I think you have to have a passion or, you know, for coaching. So like, regardless of where you are, cause not everybody is going to want to go big time, but like, let's say you do, if you want to go big time or whatever, like, you know, you regardless of where you are, like people, like if you're making people faster, if you're helping people get faster at the, you know, Division III college or at the junior college or like at the small high school with a population of like 200 people, like at the end of the day, like if you're coaching them and you're getting results, results are results, period. You know, and if those results are understood within the context of the, of their own performances and their own progressions, like it is what it is. Like if they're progressing, they're progressing. If you're getting, you know, if you're helping people get faster, stronger, jump higher and so on and so forth, like results are results and people can appreciate that. You know, at least in my experience, people can appreciate the results, you know, wherever they come from. You know what I mean? And so I think personally that there's just value in all of that. And I wouldn't give a damn, you know, where they're coaching. You know what I mean? Like if you, like I said, I started off, my first client was my sister, one of my sisters, you know, at least like as far as like experimenting with stuff.
Yeah. I have a similar story. Yeah.
Then I had little clients, you know, a few clients here, a few clients there. And people were drawn to me just because I was really fast. So they thought I knew what I was doing.
I had that from being really big. They thought I knew what I was doing. Hey, I want to be the size of that guy. And then here I am like, so green with like the performance side of things as a strength coach, but like the jumps and the sprints, but like, I had a little bit of knowledge that I first kind of came on to and I ran with it, no pun intended. And it's funny you mentioned that though, like just looking the part kind of made people trust me a little early on.
Yeah, yeah. And I screwed a lot of people up, man. Like, you know, that's just the truth. So, I think that having starting off so small, you know, with a few clients here and there and then that growing over time. And then eventually, you know, I got, you know, groups, I got a 6-year-old, a baseball team, 6-year-old, trained them for like 3 sessions a week for like 2 weeks as a short stint. But that was experience. That was very valuable experience. Then it's like, I got, you know, I started a club team here and now I'm coaching at the high school here and I'm dealing with a whole just crazy, wide variety of athletes with all kinds of different skill sets, you know, and then it just kind of grew from there, you know, and even now, like I work with, you know, world-class athletes. I work with, you know, like, Major League Baseball and, you know, NFL dudes and this, that, and the other, but I also have like my youth athletes, you know what I mean? I still coach youth, you know, and it's all valuable. So get, you know, stick your neck out there, get on the ground and start coaching and doing some work and keep track of all that stuff and, you know, put it on your resume because all of it is valuable, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I think you made a good point too. Some of people are like infatuated with the working with the, you know, professionals in college, high level athletes. And I, listen, I'm the first one to tell you when I first started my business, I got advice from someone to like not chase the 7s, 8s, and 9s and go after the 3s, 4s, and 5s. Like you're not going to make a living just training just athletes was like the first thing I was told. And then you're not going to make a living going after the higher level ones. There's something to be said for the fact that like you can't run your entire coaching career and business off the fact that like you want to just work with high level athletes, but you know, you can go after that clientele for sure, but you made a good point that like, don't just jump to that level at one point and forget about working with the youth. You see a lot of coaches do that where they kind of get to the point where they built a name and now they work with just the high level guys. Like you can still learn a lot from working with the youth, and it's refreshing to kind of give yourself a new perspective of coaching to work into. So I think that's huge to just make sure that you don't totally neglect that area, even once you become a little more well-known.
Yeah, absolutely. The youth was my foundation. That's where, like, I honestly believe that's where I developed a lot of the vast majority of the skills that I have coaching, in terms of like speaking to athletes, cueing, and all that kind of stuff. Like, I learned that through, you know, from working with those youth athletes. And I know sometimes, like, if you're, you know, there was a period of time where I wasn't working with youth athletes for a few years. And I had my first couple of youth athletes in a while, and it was like, whoa, you know, I was kind of out the loop. But they keep you honest, you know, and you know, they are responsible for teaching me how to cue, how to shape and deliver, you know, my coaching so that it makes sense, you know.
Yeah, if you could explain it to a youth athlete, you could explain it to anyone, right?
Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah. And I've experienced that. So
I just think it's refreshing. It keeps you sharp and it keeps you diverse in what you're doing. And I think it just makes you a better coach and kind of keeps you it's like the billionaire that has a business that makes sure they still get on the floor every once in a while to like see how everything is
absolutely.
Running. Right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So getting a little bit back, you know, we started with the whole drop step conversation, and then I said we were going to move away from the mechanics a little bit because I wanted to get a little bit of your background, and I'm glad we did. I wanted to shift back over into the side of the, you know, pure sprinting mechanics. And I guess the first thing I wanted to touch on is the difference between like short and tall athletes and the, you know, limb length and levers and everything. You know, quick little bit of a background in your mind, like what are some of the implications that has on mechanics?
Yeah. So basically, you know, you can have a short and a tall athlete, but then you can have a short athlete, for instance, and, you know, with, you know, shorter limbs, longer torso, right? But you can also have a short athlete with a short torso and longer limbs, which would, you know, mean that the way they express movement is going to look different.
So you're saying look at the limbs before you look at anything else?
I'd say look at it all. So like, look at, like I have a young lady who she's probably 5'5", but she has no torso and she has really long arms and really long legs, you know? So when you see her move, she has these long limbs that are going through these big ranges of motion. They're, you know, the limb velocities, like they're fast, but like, they're not going to be as fast as someone who has, you know, shorter limbs where they have to travel, you know, through shorter ranges of motion. You know what I mean? So basically I look for, if I'm dealing with someone that's really tall, like if they're tall and long and I'm taking them, you know, I'm teaching them how to accelerate, then, you know, obviously that person is going to look slower than the shorter person. Right. But that's just like, you know, the visual feedback that you'll get, that doesn't mean that they're not going to be able to move just as fast or faster along the ground than the shorter athlete. You just have to have an expectation that, like, you know, for them to hit certain positions might take a little longer. But if that person is like freaky talented, it might not, you know what I mean? So there's like, you kind of have to, the way I look at it is like you take the athlete that's standing in front of you and you build your expectations. Like maybe you have expectations going in for, like, you know, let's say how steep they'll launch and how they'll carry their arms and how their legs will cycle and so on and so forth. Maybe you'll have general expectations based off of how they look. But at the end of the day, you just kind of look at, you know, actually observe their own style of movement and then build your expectation for what is ideal for them, you know, as you go. So like, look at Usain Bolt. He's a, you know, best to ever do it, right? He's 6'5", 215. And if you watch him come out of the blocks, you know, he's not going to look as quick just based off of how his limbs are moving, how fast his limbs are moving. He's not going to look as quick as, say, Asafa Powell or, let's say, Christian Coleman, for example. Christian Coleman is probably 5'9", right? 5'9 or 5'8". But from a velocity standpoint, he's going to be moving almost just as fast, if not faster, than most of those other guys. Now, Christian Coleman has a world record in the 60-meter dash, but he's going to be moving just as fast along the ground from a velocity standpoint as those other guys. But if you look at him, it's not going to look like that. He's going to look slower because he's taller, he's longer. You know what I mean?
I've heard people say that he doesn't accelerate obviously as well as he does in top speed, just because, like you said before, like the range of motion's a little longer. Go ahead.
Yeah, typically. So when Usain Bolt tended to have his worst accelerations, it tended to be when he was coming off of when he was trying to get like really race sharp. But Usain Bolt has like the fastest splits, 10-meter segments of any sprinter on the planet. Like from 10 meters on, and that first 10-meter segment is just as fast as anybody who's ever lived. I mean, the only person there are a handful of folks that are faster than him for that first 10-meter segment. But Usain Bolt is world class accelerator, and he's world class in his acceleration and world class at top speed.
It's just that he might just be like all time in top speed. Like he's world class in acceleration, and he's in a class of his own, maybe on the top speed. Right? Exactly. Is that like a good way to look at it?
Exactly.
So that people will try to frame the acceleration as average because of that, but it's really world class. Just his top speed's that much better.
Right. He's hitting a higher top speed than everybody. But like but I think a lot of people will just respond to the optics. You know, a lot of people respond to the fact that you have a 6'5" dude who's accelerating and he looks slower. Well, yeah, there are plenty of examples of Bolt getting left, or being, slightly behind. But then we also have plenty of examples of Bolt being right there with the crew. You know what I mean? Being right there at 10 meters and then pulling away as they go. So like you can't run 9:58 and not have an acceleration pattern that's just insane. You know, you can't run 9.6s and 9.7s like that and not have an acceleration that's just the same. But it's just that like there were a lot of times where his acceleration was suffered because, maybe he was just coming off of injury and he had some time off or time away from races. But yeah, he's one of the best out there in accelerators out there, hands down. Like if you ask the same people, if you ask a lot of people, like who is a better accelerator, Usain Bolt or Tyson Gay, I would venture to believe that the average person would say Tyson Gay, you know. But like you watch those two, when Usain Bolt, when Tyson ran 9.71 and Usain ran 9.58, like you see a better acceleration pattern from Usain, you know, and you'll see a typical acceleration pattern from Tyson. Tyson was. You know, not that great at accelerating. He tended to pull his way up the track, and that posed a problem. His strength was his strength was also when he got out by running. So he was good. He just there were times where he would get left, but he'd get left for different reasons. You know.
Yeah, for sure. So looking a little bit into acceleration mechanics and speed. So we talked before about the importance of relative strength, and in the sports world, many have this misconception, unfortunately, of quick feet. Like they think like, oh, I'm not getting, going fast enough. My feet have to get quicker. And it's just like the misinterpretation of the fact that like acceleration is longer ground contact and more force is important in that whole type of thing. So it's just really like kind of off base, and when you consider the fact that like people want quick feet, but that's really not what makes you accelerate better.
Yeah. So quick feet. Yeah. So you have this, they're kind of two things that I tend to see. So you'll see people who will accelerate with quick feet, and maybe they get up to, you know, maybe they're actually really quick, like they're covering ground pretty well, but then like, you know, what, at what cost? Like if they have to, you know, like in track and field, if someone is spinning their wheels, they might have a fast 30, but then they'll get left behind at, you know, from 60 or 70 meters on because they wasted a whole lot of energy trying to be quick early on. There are countless examples of track athletes in a 100 meter dash with really quick accelerations, but not efficient, but not totally efficient, 100 meters, right? Then you have the issue of the people who are literally spinning their wheels and going nowhere. So I compare that to like, if you're in the cars, you have the Nissan GTR, which is all wheel drive, traction control, launch control, all that stuff. And then if you take a, let's say a Camaro, right? Camaro is going to be rear wheel drive, lots of horsepower and all of that kind of stuff. Those two race, light goes green, which car is going to come off the line, which car is going to connect, right? And be gone. Well, it's going to be the GTR with the all-wheel drive and the traction control, which also happens to have over 550 horses, right? Well, that all-wheel drive traction control is my example of a powerful acceleration where you're going through the necessary ranges of motion, the foot is striking the ground in the right place relative to the hip, and you're being patient enough, like, you're being more powerful than quick. So the range of motion is right, so the limbs are going through, you know, some large sweeps, the thighs are flexing and extending, you know, through large ranges of motion. And so you're going to connect, you're going to grab and be gone, right? Someone spinning their wheels is wasting a lot of energy. And that sounds good because we know we want to get from point A to B, as fast as possible. But, you know, we're sacrificing efficiency by just spinning the wheels. Over time, when you practice being powerful and you practice moving with the appropriate ranges of motion, then those ranges of motion end up feeling quick. They end up being quicker and feeling quick.
That's what I tell people all the time. It's like you think of your feet, but it's like the feet get down quicker and get up quicker, you know, with improved rate of force development. But that's just the ability of the limb to go through extension and flexion at a faster rate. So it's not your feet that you're chasing. It's like getting more powerful through, you know, knee and hip extension. And you know what I mean? Like it's like that's what dictates it. So it's like you're thinking of it as quick feet, but what it really is how, you know, powerful and the rate in which I can move through my limbs going through the ranges of motion.
Yeah, exactly. How are you giving yourself ample time to produce force? All right. And that's, you know, and are you among other things, right? You want to check a number of boxes, but are you giving yourself time to produce the amount of force you need to produce as efficiently as possible, as aggressively, as violently, and as efficiently as possible, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So a little bit into, and this is something I wanted to ask you as well, with acceleration mechanics. I always see the debate between people saying, oh, like, you know, you need full triple extension. And then the people that say, oh, like, you know, not everyone achieves full triple extension. And I look at it as like the optimal amount depends on the athlete and the sprinter. Like, would you agree with that?
Totally. I when I talk about triple extension, I'm just talking about joint action. You know what I mean? These days, right? So, I don't think anyone is going to get 100% full extension of the ankle, knee, and hip, right? But you're looking for that total expression of the acceleration where those joints are extending and they extend to an end point or they extend to an ideal place or ideal depth for that person to continue to accelerate competently. So I still look for like when someone comes out of their stance right before toe off, I'm still going to look for, to be able to draw a straight line from the ankle through the ears. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have quote unquote full extension. You know what I mean? For me, it's like that athlete, I always look for an athlete to extend or to launch to an extension endpoint. And whatever that endpoint end is whatever it has to be for them to be able to reposition the limbs or switch and get back to the ground, with the timing being right, the limb movements being right, the ground contact being right, and so on and so forth. Right. So I don't really get, I don't talk about triple extension in the sense that, you know, we're looking for, that we should be looking for full extension of those joints. I'm just looking at it as like, all right, this is, you know, you're in this position and you're going to launch or you're going to project. And that basically means that, you know, those joints are flexed and those joints have to extend powerfully, all three of them. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
how deep they go depends on the person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So, yeah.
So we hit on the things we're looking for in acceleration a lot when we talked about the baseball starts, but just to summary quick before we get into more top speed stuff, obviously longer ground contact times, right? Like, I think that's the one thing people need to understand is like, don't rush that process. Like, the more force needs to be displaced when we're going through acceleration. So it does take a little bit longer time, you know, versus the ground contact time and top speed. And, you know, and obviously, you know, shin and torso angles or anything else that, you find important enough to mention when it comes to, acceleration mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah. People just gotta, you know, they have to understand that the you know, part of the reason why those ground contact times are longer is just because the velocity is slower at that point.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going from a static start, you're going from zero velocity. And so your job is to build momentum. And so
have to exert some more force to get that done, right?
Yeah. You have to exert force. Yeah. You have to exert a lot of force to overcome inertia and get moving. And, you know, each step of the way, you know, those ground contacts will get shorter and shorter, like with the change in velocity.
And you're also building up kinetic energy from the ground impacts too. That's the thing people don't realize. Yeah. Like, that's basic. Like, Verkhoshansky talked a lot about that with plyometrics. I'm a big Verkhoshansky nerd with plyometrics, but like that is what's going on. You're accumulating a kinetic energy as you go through your strides.
Yeah. 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 So when, you know, as you get closer and closer to top speed, the contact times are shortening. But velocity is high and it's just a pop off the ground. It's just a strike off the ground, you know, which would be optimal for that, phase of the race or optimal for maximum velocity. But that's, you know, that's a big reason why, you know, you're going from zero velocity, having to overcome inertia to build momentum. You have to generate a lot of force and it just takes more time, you know.
Yeah, for sure. So how important would you say, we talked about this a little bit already too, but relative strength in that, you know, acceleration phase, like that, I tell people all the time, like, that's one of the best ways to improve, your start is relative strength and just, you know, how powerful you are relative to the mass of your body.
Yeah, it's super important, especially at like the younger age group, you know, younger age group, like to get stronger, because we know force is a large component, the ability to produce force is a large component to acceleration. So, you know, being able to produce, you know, high force with relatively low body weight, right? You know, because that
mass specific turn, force, right?
Yeah, right. Mass specific force, and it gets into the efficiency discussion. You know what I mean? Like how much energy, how much work do you have to do to get going? Right. And like what's the cost? And so if someone is entirely too heavy, or if they're too heavy and their mass is not ideal relative to their absolute strength, then you may have an issue. Now, as the athlete gets older and more experienced, you know, relative strength should still be, you know, pretty high. But how to establish or develop that strength, you know, it will, and how much exposure you need to the type of work that you need to keep those numbers there becomes more variable, you know, because people may interpret the importance of relative strength as meaning that now we have to go, you know, we got to go postal on like doing max effort work all the time, right? So I think what as we look at what's important for acceleration, we still have to look at the bigger picture. We still have to look at the big picture in general when we talk about, you know, acceleration is a product of strength, power, coordination, rhythm, you know, all these types of things. There's still an elasticity component. Then there's a technical component where, like, you can have a great strength to weight ratio, but like you can have crappy acceleration technique.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It all goes together.
Like, yeah, exactly. But it's important. It's important. It's just, you know, people have, you know, would want to understand, like, you know, where it fits or where it stands in the grand scheme of things, or when you look at the big picture, you know. So
yeah, like there's, you know, so much more to it than, all right, like if my squat goes up from 450 to 600, I'm good to go. It's like you really start to understand that as you go along. Like there's obviously a lot of importance to it, but there's diminishing returns, like we mentioned before, and you know, points where that might not be as helpful as it might have once been. Moving a little bit more over to top speed, because I want to talk to you about some top speed stuff, and then maybe a little bit strength training, and then we're gonna wrap it up. But top speed mechanics, obviously, like I'll read you some of the things that I had listed off in my outline, and then maybe you could kind of expand on them. You know, I talked a little bit about the vertical impulse of the stride and the cycle motion that you get versus what it's like in acceleration. The importance of, you know, a little bit of a lack of tension and not being too tensed up. Like you can sometimes see the elite level sprinters, like their cheeks are flapping and they're just kind of going nice and free. And then a little bit about like maybe that recovery leg action and how much the balance between, too much backside swing, like, you know, getting the ankle up to the butt too much versus the, you know, the knee drive, and how that kind of goes, hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's say, as far as the vertical impulse is, like, so at top speed, you know, contrasting that to acceleration, where the, with acceleration, there's a large horizontal propulsive force component, and that has a lot to do with the forward orientation of the body and where the feet are striking the ground relative to the hip, right? As the athlete gets more and more upright, then that kind of bias shifts more to a, you know, more to favor more the vertical force component, and that has a lot to do with, you know, gravity and being able to keep the hips high and so on and so forth. I know there at one point, there was a big debate, within the track and field community about, you know, like what forces are important and this, that, and other. And I think that ultimate conclusion that it came down to was just that, like, horizontal and vertical forces are really all important. It's just that they shift, the bias shifts with the change in velocity and the change in posture. You know what I mean? Now, the other point you raised was with the limb movement, with like heel recovery. Is that what you had?
Yes.
Too. Yeah. So, I think like with heel recovery. So front side, if you look at Ralph Mann's work, Ralph Mann, he's one of, I think a handful of folks that, and I think it's like, there's a pretty decent agreement that, like, you would tend to want to have sprinters to have more of a front side biased cycle. So meaning like when that foot at toe off, that knee, that thigh is more urgently popping to the front. Now, how much front side an athlete is going to be is going to depend on their physiology, their morphology, their anatomy, you know, so there's going to be some bandwidth there. But when you start to see like expression of excessive backside mechanics for any given athlete, a lot of that will have to do with like where they're striking the ground to begin with, and how much time they're spending on the ground. So let's say if they're an overstrider or a heel striker. Heel striker is a little bit more rare, but let's say if they're an overstrider, they strike out way in front of the hip, and they strike out on the toe. So then the heel collapses, and then the foot is on the ground for a long period of time, that the pelvis is probably dumped forward, right? Or you probably have an anterior orientation of the pelvis. And because of that, you'll tend to have like that long ground contact time will tend to assist in shooting that heel high up the butt, as opposed to the thigh popping forward and the heel tucking under the hamstring. You know what I mean? Sometimes it is, you know, when you're looking at like the guys running a 60-meter dash, for example, you'll see guys that have, you know, they know that early on in the acceleration, they're going to be pushing hard, and they're pushing and then they're getting upright. And as they get upright, because those ground contacts are shorter, then there's going to be more of a strike. That strike, you know, when that foot comes off the ground, you should see more of that thigh pop forward, and there'll be like more of a forward, front side orientation, of the knee, of the thigh. But if that athlete, let's say they're in the lead at 40 meters, and then someone starts to run up on them, and if that athlete starts pushing again, like they pushed in acceleration, then all of a sudden the hips dump, and then the ground contacts get longer, and then they start going backside again. So I think, you know, naturally you'll see, when you compare acceleration, lower limb recovery to top speed, because velocity is higher at top speed, the limbs have to fold tighter so that angular velocity is high, and moment of inertia about the hip is relatively low. You know what I mean? So whereas in acceleration, the limbs are going to be a little bit more open. Moment of inertia about the hip is going to be more specific to that, the acceleration phase, where like ground contacts are longer and so on and so forth. You're building momentum, overcoming inertia. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I think the point you made about the hips dumping is huge in it, and the fact that like that really impacts, that from what I've seen, like that positioning of that and the torso can really impact that recovery leg as well.
Yeah, totally.
So finishing up with things a little bit, we've touched on strength training throughout a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit about like you being a person that maybe was putting too much emphasis on strength training through your career, but for the people that aren't putting enough of emphasis on it, that plyometrics, things like that, you know, how much value do you place on strength training? We've talked a little bit about like, you know, to the point where there might be diminishing returns and focusing on other stuff, but we didn't really talk much about the value of it in general. What would your thoughts be on that?
Yeah, so I place a lot of value on strength training, but I treat it more of something that supports the work that I'm doing at the track or in the field. You know what I mean? So like, so with younger athletes, then there'll be a much greater emphasis on strength training, because like strength is a big key, right? But at the same time, like if, you know, they're playing a sport, like I'm going to treat the weight room as the supporter of the sport that they actually play. So I'm trying to be very careful about like, you know, how much exposure they have to it, how frequently they're exposed to what type of lifting they're doing, and so on and so forth. Because what I don't want to do is I don't want to rob them. I don't want to take the weight room and use that to rob them of the resources they need to be good at their sport. You know what I mean? You know, just like, you know, how you mentioned earlier, like free, relaxed, easy running. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like sometimes you can take an athlete that is, you know, they're like overdoing it in the weight room. Let's say they believe that like, you know what, strength, I got to be super strong to be fast. So like they go overkill, right? So now you have an extremely, extremely tense athlete who runs like a robot, and they're not able to like access this like level of relaxation that doesn't mean like you just turn your body off, but a relaxation that allows you to have access to more powerful fluid and aggressive ranges of motion. You know what I mean? So what I try to be careful, you know, I use the weight room to you know, to build strength, to hopefully build a more robust athlete, to be able to develop certain qualities that support what we're trying to do on the field or on the track, and whatnot. But I'm, but I try to be careful of doing so much in the weight room, like let's say just doing too much volume, going too heavy all the time, or trying to be too specific, that now we're competing for resources. The weight room is competing for the same resources that the track is or the field is and whatnot. Like, 'cause I made that mistake myself. You know, I was so strong. I was like, you know, I loved it because like I can squat, you know, 700 plus pounds and I can do this and do that. But like when it came to sprinting, I lost, you know, I literally weight trained those qualities that I needed to have to be faster and more explosive on the track. I really trained it out of me, you know what I mean? So I love the weight room. Like I said, I grew up reading, you know, bodybuilding magazines and powerlifting magazines and, you know, and shoot, it started with freaking, you know, Marvel Comics and DC Comics, you know, but I learned throughout my career, and it took a while, but I learned throughout my career to understand its place and respect the fact that like, if you go overkill, you can destroy the things that make an athlete good at their actual sport. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. Like, use it to support them, understand how much it can help them, but, don't get to the point where you're making that like the thing that, you know, you think dictates everything. Like, it's all part of it. It's a very important part of it, but, you know when, you know, you need to make things, or change things and things like that. Plyometric wise, this is a quote that I saw and I thought it was fantastic. I've seen fast sprinters who don't jump high, but I've never seen someone who jumps high not run fast. And I kind of use that when I tell people like the importance I place on the vertical jump test. You know, yes, there are probably some sprinters who don't jump high just because of the difference in, you know, let's say acceleration, you know, the linear force development versus vertical, all that kind of stuff. But I've yet to see someone who improves the vertical not run faster. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's an interesting quote because I haven't, like, that's not something that I've really thought about as much.
I didn't either until it was said. It was from Joseph Potts, Top Speed in Kansas City. He's great.
I'm familiar with Joe.
He tweeted that, and I was like, man, like all these years, I've been seeing guys go from like a 26 vert to a 32, and they run faster, and their times are down. But I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that, you know, I mean that, yeah, that would make sense to me. Like if you have someone who is, you know, if they're improving their, they're able to improve their vertical, let's say. In order for that to happen, certain things have to be improved as well, you know, and, so force production, rate of force production, you know, and things like that have to be improved as well. I would say that there's, those correlations I'm not sure how strong the correlations are, but I think that like I too have seen dudes that have been like crazy fast, but, you know, the vertical that you would have expected from them, they didn't have. But like, so that's interesting. That's something that I got to think about, a little bit more because I haven't really heard that
too much. It kind of resonates, right?
Yeah, totally. Like it's, that's an interesting quote. I'm going to investigate that more because I think that there's a lot of, it would appear that there's a lot of truth to that, you know? At least like, you know, let's say someone improved their vertical, like you at the very least will see improvements in like that first 10, you know what I mean? And, you know, something like that. So it's like, yeah, that would make sense to me.
So, yeah, I need for to sure.
Be in touch with
I always say I hate to put my guests on the spot, but I always do it because I think it's important. Parting thoughts for the listeners, anything you wanted to talk about you didn't get to touch on, anything you want to kind of summarize up with what we've talked about so far and leave the guests with before we wrap things up?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we touched on a lot of, sprinting and acceleration and so on and so forth. And I think that, like, for all of us in the field, I think one of the things that can help us, you know, continue to improve at, like, assessing movement and like, you know, knowing what, you know, what things are important for, like, accurate and good expressions of movement, let's say acceleration or, you know, and anything that it is, I think it's important for us to understand, like, just basic principles, you know, like we talked earlier about, you know, the difference between the crossover and the drop step. And what I brought that to was, like, how similar, like, if we're talking about, we're basically talking about acceleration, from, you know, comparing a linear acceleration to a lateral acceleration. But I think that if you just understand acceleration principles alone, that would help to understand what types of, you know, techniques would hold more value or would be more beneficial in trying to complete a task. And then I think once you understand those things, then you can start to play around and work within a, you know, you can then try to understand who your athletes are within those guidelines or within that context, you know. But I think when we figure out when we understand principles or seek to understand principles more, then it helps us with problem solving. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that little last bit you just put there. I might even want to tweet that. Once we understand principles, it helps us with problem solving a little better. Understanding, like, the base of everything, like the things that guide how we're programming, how we're training. Once you have that and you don't look at things in such a superficial way, you can make adjustments and changes. Like, when you understand, like, a great example of that is when you understand, I'm typing this out so I don't forget it. When you understand principles, I think that's fantastic. You can, what was it? When you understand principles, you can better make change. I think it was,
you can solve, you know,
or solve it problems. Make us better problems. Yeah.
I would say even, and, you know, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that we see all the time on social media and all over the place. And I think that when people are driven or seek to understand basic movement principles, basic, you know, just the foundation.
Even the principles of the adaptations you're looking for, the attributes you're looking for, would lead you out of the pitfalls of making that mistake of having your athlete, you know, go to the gym and focus on squatting three times a week when they're already squatting 500 pounds and they're not getting faster. You wouldn't make that mistake if you understood the adaptations you needed to achieve the goals you wanted, right?
Right. You just get a much better BS meter, you know?
Yeah, and it's just like you get much better at making changes. Like, you know when to, you know, stay the course and stay on what you're doing. You know when to kind of, quote-unquote, jump ship on stuff. It just makes you better at, like, figuring out what's needed next to take your athlete to the next level for with whatever their goal is, whether it's sprinting, a higher vertical jump, to be more, you know, explosive in their first couple steps. Like, you can really know when you need to make changes. When I need to say, hey, like, you know, getting from 250 on the trap bar to 450 or 500 was huge, but getting from 500 to 750 might not be nearly as big, and maybe it's time to shift my focus to something else.
Exactly. I mean, that's spot on, in my opinion.
Yeah, so. I think that was a great way to kind of wrap things up. That might be one of my between the vertical quote that we mentioned and then the one with the understanding principles and problem solving. That was a pretty, you know, great way to end and wrap things up. So I want to thank you for coming on. That was awesome. And I've yet to do an episode that was, like, really, really, like, just fully built upon sprinting and everything that goes into it. It's something I talk about so much, and I love improving, you know, speed with guys, but being able to get somebody that, you know, really specializes in that and has so much knowledge on it was huge. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you asking me to come on, man. I think it was fun. And like I said, we wanted to do this for a while, so it's good to be able to finally both of our schedules connect so we can make it happen. So it's good. I had a good time, man, so I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Me too. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.